left. Her left eye felt solid and heavy, as if it were made of lead instead of soft tissue. Vic stretched out in the heat to wait for Wayne to return. She wanted to doze, but every time she drifted off, she twitched awake all of a sudden, hearing the Crazy Girl song in her head. Vic had heard the Crazy Girl song for the first time when she was in the mental hospital in Denver, which was where she went after she burned the townhouse down. The Crazy Girl song had only four lines, but no one, not Bob Dylan, not John Lennon, not Byron or Keats, had ever strung together four lines of such insightful and emotionally direct verse. No one sleeps a wink when I sing this song, and I'm going to sing it all night long. Vic wishes she could ride her fucking bike away. Might as well wish for a ride in Santa's sleigh. This song had woken her on her very first evening in the clinic. A woman was singing it somewhere in the lockdown, and she wasn't just singing it to herself. She was serenading Vic directly. The Crazy Girl scream-shouted her song three or four times a night, usually just when Vic was drifting off to sleep. Sometimes the Crazy Girl got to laughing so hard she couldn't carry the tune all the way through to the end. Vic did some screaming, too. She screamed for someone to shut that cunt up. Other people yelled, the whole ward would get to yelling, everyone screaming to be quiet, to let them sleep, to make it stop. Vic screamed herself hoarse until the orderlies came in to hold her down and put the needle in her arm. In the day, Vic angrily searched the faces of the other patients, looking for signs of guilt and exhaustion, but all of them looked guilty and exhausted. In group therapy sessions, she listened intently to the others, thinking the midnight singer would give herself away by having a hoarse voice, but they all sounded hoarse, from the difficult nights, the bad coffee, the cigarettes. Eventually the evening came when Vic stopped hearing from the Crazy Girl with her crazy song. She thought they had moved her to another wing, finally showing some consideration for the other patients. Vic had been out of the hospital for half a year before she finally recognized the voice, knew who the Crazy Girl had been. "Do we own the motorcycle in the garage?" Wayne asked, and then, before she had time to process the question, he said, "What are you singing?" She hadn't realized she was whispering it to herself until that very moment. It sounded much better in a soft voice than it did when Vic had been scream-laughing it in the loony bin. Vic sat up, rubbing her face. "I don't know. Nothing." Wayne gave her a dark and doubtful look. He made his way out onto the dock in mincing, effortful steps, Hooper slouching along behind like a tame bear. Wayne carried a big, battered yellow toolbox, clutched the handle in both hands. A third of the way out, he lost his grip, and it dropped with a crash. The dock shook. "I got the tackle box," Wayne said. "That's not a tackle box. You said look for a brown box." "That's yellow." "It's brown in spots." "It's rusted in spots." "Yeah, so rusted brown." He unbuckled the toolbox, pushed back the lid, frowned at the contents. "Easy mistake," she said. "Is this maybe for fishing?" he asked, and pulled out a curious instrument. It looked like the blade of a dull miniature scythe, small enough to fit in his palm. "It's shaped like a hook." Vic knew what it was, although it had been years since she'd seen one. Then she registered at last what Wayne had said when he first walked out onto the dock. "Let me see that box," Vic said. She turned it around to stare in at a collection of flat, rusted wrenches, an air pressure gauge, and an old key with a rectangular head, the word Triumph stamped into it. "Where'd you find this?"
"It was on the seat of the old motorcycle. Did the motorcycle come with the house?"
"Show me," Vic said. The Carriage House. Vic had only been in the Carriage House once, when she first looked at the property. She had talked to her mother about cleaning the place out and using it as an artist's studio. So far, though, her pencils and paints hadn't made it any farther than the bedroom closet, and the Carriage House was as cluttered as the day they had moved in. It was a long, narrow room, so crowded with junk it was impossible for anyone to walk a straight line to the back wall. There were a few stalls where horses had been kept. Vic loved the smell of the place, a perfume of gasoline, dirt, old dry hay, and wood that had baked and aged for 80 summers. If Vic were Wayne's age, she would have lived in the rafters,
among the pigeons and flying squirrels. That didn't seem to be Wayne's thing, though. Wayne didn't interact with nature. He took pictures of it with his iPhone and then bent over the screen and poked at it. His favorite thing about the lake house was that it had Wi-Fi. It wasn't that he wanted to stay indoors. He wanted to stay inside his phone. It was his bridge away from a world where his mom was a crazy alcoholic, and Dad was a 300-pound car mechanic who had dropped out of high school and who wore an Iron Man costume to comic book conventions. The motorcycle was in the back of the carriage house, a paint-spattered tarp thrown over it, but the shape beneath it still discernible. Vic spotted it from just inside the doors and wondered how she could have missed it the last time she'd stuck her head in here. But she only wondered for a moment. No one knew better than Vic McQueen how easy it was for an important thing to be lost amid a great deal of visual clutter. The whole place was like a scene she might paint for one of the search engine books. Find your way to the motorcycle through the labyrinth of junk, without crossing a tripwire, and escape. Not a bad notion for a scene, really. Something to file away for further thought. She couldn't afford to ignore a single good idea. Could anyone? Wayne got one corner of the tarp and she got the other, and they flipped it back. The bike wore a coat of grime and sawdust, a quarter inch thick. The handlebars and gauges were veiled in spider webs. The headlight hung loose from the socket by its wires. Under the dust, the teardrop-shaped gas tank was cranberry and silver, with the word Triumph embossed on it in chrome. It looked like a motorcycle out of an old biker movie. Not a biker film full of bare tits, washed-out color, and Peter Fonda, but one of the older, tamer motorcycle films, something in black and white that involved a lot of racing and talk about the man. Vic loved it already. Wayne ran a hand over the seat, looked at the gray fuzz on his palm. Do we get to keep it? As if it were a stray cat. Of course they didn't get to keep it. It wasn't theirs. It belonged to the old woman who was renting them the house. And yet Vic felt that in some way it already belonged to her. I doubt it even runs, she said. So? Wayne asked with the casual certainty of a 12-year-old. Fix it. Dad could tell you how. Your dad already told me how. For 8 years she had tried to be Lou's girl. It had not always been good, and it had never been easy. But there had been some happy days in the garage. Lou fixing bikes and Vic airbrushing them, sound garden on the radio and cold bottles of beer in the fridge. She would crawl around the bikes with him, holding his light and asking questions. He taught her about fuses, brake lines, manifolds. She had liked being with him then, and had almost liked being herself. So you think we can keep it? Wayne asked again. It belongs to the old dame renting us the house. I could ask if she'd sell. I bet she'll let us have it, he said. He wrote the word ours in the dust on the side of the tank. What kind of old lady is going to want to haul ass around on a mother like this? The kind standing right next to you, she said, and reached past him and wiped her palm across the word ours. Dust fluffed up into a shaft of early morning sunshine, a flurry of gold flakes. Below where the word ours had been, Vic wrote, mine. Wayne held up his iPhone and took a picture. Haverhill. Every day after lunch, Sigmund de Zoet had an hour to himself to paint his tiny soldiers. It was his favorite hour of the day. He listened to the Berlin Orchestra performing the Frobisher Sextet, Cloud Atlas, and painted the Hun in their 19th-century helmets and coats with tails and gas masks. He had a miniature landscape on a 6-foot by 6-foot sheet of plywood that was supposed to represent an acre of Verdun-sur-Meuse, an expanse of blood-soaked mud, burned trees, tangled shrubbery, barbed wire, and bodies. Sig was proud of his careful brushwork. He painted gold braid on epaulets, microscopic brass buttons on coats, spots of rust on helmets. He felt that when his little men were painted well, they possessed attention, a suggestion that they might at any moment begin to move on their own and charge the French line. He was working on them the day it finally happened, the day when they finally did begin to move. He was painting a wounded Hun, the little man grabbing at his chest, his mouth open in silent cry. Sig had a daub of red on the end of the brush, meant to put a splash of it around the German soldier's fingers, but when he reached out, the Hun backed away. Sigmund stared, studying the one-inch soldier under the bright glare of the lamp on its articulated arm. He reached with the tip of the brush again, and again the soldier swayed away. Sig tried a third time. "Hold still, you little bastard," he thought. And missed entirely, wasn't even close, painted a crimson slash across the metal lampshade instead. And it wasn't just that one soldier moving anymore. It was all of them. They lurched toward one another, wavering like candle flames. Sigmund rubbed his hand across his forehead, felt a hot and slimy sweat there. He inhaled deeply and smelled gingerbread cookies. "A stroke," he thought. "I am having a stroke." Only he thought it in Dutch, because for the moment English eluded him, and never mind he had spoken English as his first language since he was 5. He reached for the edge of the table to push himself to his feet, and missed and fell. Sig hit the walnut floor on his right side and felt something snap in his hip. It broke like a dry stick under a German jackboot. The whole house shook with the force of his fall, and he thought, still in Dutch, "That will bring Giselle." "Help!" he called. "Ich heb ihn slag! Nur! Nur!" That didn't sound right. But he needed a moment to figure out why. Dutch. She wouldn't understand Dutch. "Giselle! I have fallen down!" She didn't come. Didn't respond in any way. He tried to think what she could be doing that she wouldn't hear him. Then wondered if she was outside with the air conditioning repairman. The repairman, a dumpy little man named Bing something, had turned up in grease-stained overalls to replace a condenser coil as part of a factory recall. Sig's head seemed a bit clearer down here on the floor. When he had been up on the stool, the air had started to seem soupy and slow, overheated and faintly cloying, what with the sudden smell of gingerbread. Down here, though, it was cooler, and the world seemed inclined to behave. He saw a screwdriver he had been missing for months, nestled among some dust bunnies under the work table. His hip was broken. He was sure of that. Could feel the fracture in it like a hot wire embedded under the skin. He thought if he could get up, though, he could use his stool as a makeshift walker to get across the room to the door and out into the hall. Perhaps he could reach the door and shout for the air conditioning man. Or to Vic McQueen across the street. Except, no. Vicky was off in New Hampshire somewhere with that boy of hers. No. If he could get as far as the phone in the kitchen, he would just have to call emergency services and hope Giselle found him before the ambulance pulled into the driveway. He didn't want to shock her more than was necessary. Sig reached up with one gangly arm, got the stool, and struggled to his feet, keeping his weight off the left leg. It hurt anyway. He heard bone click. "Giselle!" he screamed again, his voice a throaty roar. "Hot damn, Giselle!" He leaned over the stool, both hands on its edge, and took a long, trembling breath, and smelled the Christmassy odor of gingerbread again. He almost flinched, the fragrance was so strong and clear. A stroke, he thought again. This is what happened when you were stroking out. The brain misfired and you smelled things that weren't there, while the world drooped around you, melting like dirty snow in a warm spring rain. He turned himself to face the door, which was not 12 paces away. The door to his studio hung wide open. He could not imagine how Giselle could fail to hear him shouting if she was anywhere in the house. She was either outside by the noisy air conditioner, or shopping, or dead. He considered this array of possibilities again. Outside by the noisy air conditioner, shopping, or dead, and was disquieted to find the third possibility not quite preposterous. He lifted the stool an inch off the floor, moved it forward, set it down, hobbled forward with it. Now that he was standing, the inside of his head was going light again, his thoughts drifting like goose feathers on a warm breeze. A song was running around and around in his head, stuck in an idiot loop. "There was an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die."
Only the song grew in volume, building and building until it no longer seemed to be inside his head, but in the air around him, coming down the hall.
There was an old lady who swallowed a spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her, sang the voice. It was high-pitched, off-key, and curiously hollow, like a voice heard at a distance through a ventilation shaft. Sig glanced up and saw a man in a gas mask moving past the open door. The man in the gas mask had Giselle by the hair and was dragging her down the hall. Giselle didn't seem to mind. She wore a neat blue linen dress and matching blue heels, but as she was hauled along, one of the shoes pulled loose and fell off her foot. The gas mask man had her long chestnut hair, streaked with white, wrapped around one fist. Her eyes were closed, her narrow, gaunt face serene. The gas mask man turned his head, looked in at him. Sig had never seen anything so awful. It was like in that movie with Vincent Price, where the scientist crossed himself with an insect. His head was a rubber bulb with shining lenses for eyes and a grotesque valve for a mouth. Something was wrong in Sig's brain, something maybe worse than a stroke. Could a stroke make you hallucinate? One of his painted Huns had strolled right off his model of Verdun and into his back hallway, was abducting his wife. Maybe that was why Sig was struggling to stay upright. The Hun were invading Haverhill and had bombed the street with mustard gas. Although it didn't smell like mustard, it smelled like cookies. The gas mask man held up a finger to indicate he would be back shortly, then continued down the hallway, towing Giselle by the hair. He began to sing again. "There was an old lady," the gas mask man sang, "who swallowed a goat? Just opened her throat and swallowed a goat. What a greedy bitch!" Sig slumped over the stool. He couldn't feel his legs. He reached to wipe the sweat out of his face and poked himself in the eye. Boots clomped across the workshop floor. It took an effort of will for Sig to lift his head. It felt as if there were a great weight balanced on top of it, a 20-pound stack of iron. The gas mask man stood over the model of Verdun, looking down at the cratered ruin, stitched with barbed wire, his hands on his hips. Sig recognized the man's clothes at last. He wore the oil-stained jumpsuit of the air conditioner repairman. Little men," the gas mask man said. "I love little men. Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen, we daren't go hunting for fear of little men." He looked at Sig and said, "Mr. Mack says I'm a rhyming demon. I say I'm just a poet and didn't know it. How old is your wife, mister?" Sig had no intention of answering. He wanted to ask what the repairman had done with Giselle, but instead he said, "I married her in 1976. My wife is 59, 15 years younger than myself." "You dog, you, robbing the cradle. No kids?" No, I have ants in my brain." "That's the sevoflurane," the gas mask man said. "I pumped it in through your air conditioner. I can tell that your wife never had kids. Those hard little tits. I gave them a squeeze, and I can tell you, women who have had babies don't have tits like that." "Why are you doing this? Why are you here?" Sig asked. "You live across the street from Vic McQueen, and you have a 2-car garage, but only 1 car," the gas mask man told him. "When Mr. Manx comes back around the corner, he'll have a place to park. The wheels on the wraith go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels on the wraith go round and round all day long." Sig Dezote became aware of a series of sounds, a hiss, a scratch, and a thump, repeating over and over. He couldn't tell where they were coming from. The noise seemed to be inside his head. in the same way that the Gas Mask Man's song had seemed to be inside his head for a while. That hiss, scratch, and thump was what he had now, in place of thoughts. The Gas Mask Man looked down at him. Now, Victoria McQueen looks like she has a real set of mommy titties. You've seen them firsthand. What do you think of her tits? Sig stared up at him. He understood what the Gas Mask Man was asking, but could not think how to reply to such a question. Vic McQueen was just 8 years old. In Sig's mind, she had become a child again, a girl with a boy's bicycle. She came over now and then to paint figurines. It was a pleasure to watch her work, painting little men with quiet devotion, eyes narrowed as if she were squinting down a long tunnel, trying to see what was at the other end. That is her place across the street, isn't it? The Gas Mask Man said. Sig intended not to tell him, not to collaborate. Collaborate was the word that came to his mind, not cooperate. Yes, he heard himself say. Then he said, why did I tell you that? Why am I answering your questions? I am not a collaborator. That's the sevoflurane, too, the Gas Mask Man said. You wouldn't believe some of the things people used to tell me after I gave them some of the sweet old gingerbread smoke. This one old grandma, like 64 years old at least, told me the only time she ever came was when she took it up the pooper. 64. Right? Will you still need me? Will you still ream me when I'm 64? He giggled, the innocent bubbling laughter of a child. It is a truth serum, Sig said. It took a profound effort to verbalize this question. Each word was a bucket of water that had to be laboriously drawn up from a deep well by hand. Not exactly, but it sure relaxes your intuitions, opens you up to suggestion. You wait till your wife starts to come around. She'll be gobbling my cock just like it's lunch and she missed breakfast. She'll just think it's the thing to do. Don't worry. I won't make you watch. You'll be dead by then. Listen. Where is Vic McQueen? I've been watching the house all day. It doesn't look like there's anyone home. She isn't away for the summer, is she? That'd be a pain. That'd be a pain in the brain. But Sigmund de Zoet didn't answer. He was distracted. It had come to him finally what he was hearing. What was producing that hiss, that scratch, that thump? It wasn't inside his head at all. It was the record he had been listening to. The Berlin Orchestra playing the Cloud Atlas Sextet. The music was over. Lake Winnipesaukee. When Wayne went to day camp, Vic went to work on the new book, and The Triumph. Her editor had suggested maybe it was time for a holiday-themed search engine. Thought A Christmas Adventure could be a big seller. The notion at first was a whiff of sour milk. Vic flinched from it reflexively in disgust. But with a few weeks to turn it over in her mind, she could see how brutally commercial such an item would be. She could picture as well how cute search engine would look in a candy cane-striped cap and a scarf. It never once occurred to her that a robot modeled on the engine of a Vulcan motorcycle would not have any need for a scarf. It would look right. She was a cartoonist, not an engineer. Reality could get stuffed. She cleared a space in the back corner of the carriage house for her easel and made a start. That first day she went for 3 hours, using her blue non-photographic pencil to draw a lake of cracking ice. Search Engine and his little friend Bonnie clutched one another on a chunk of floating glacier. Mad Mobius Strip was under there in a submarine, crafted to look like a kraken, tentacles thrusting up around them. At least she thought she was drawing tentacles. Vic worked as always, with the music turned up, and her mind switched off. While she was drawing, her face was as smooth and unlined as a child's, as untroubled, too. She kept at it until her hand cramped,
then quit and walked out into the day, stretching her back, arms over her head, listening to her spine crack. She went into the cottage to pour herself a glass of iced tea. Vic didn't bother with lunch, hardly ate when she was working on a book, and returned to the carriage house to think about what belonged on page 2. She figured it couldn't hurt to tinker with the triumph while she mulled it over. She planned to bang at the motorcycle for an hour or so and then go back to search engine. Instead, she worked 3 hours and was 10 minutes late to pick Wayne up from camp. After that, it was the book in the morning and the bike in the afternoon. She learned to set an alarm so she'd always be on time to get Wayne. By the end of June, she had a whole stack of pages roughed out and had stripped the Triumph down to the engine and the bare metal frame. She sang while she worked, although she was rarely aware of it. "No one sleeps a wink when I sing this song. I'm gonna sing it all night long," she sang when she worked on the bike. And when she worked on the book, she sang, "Dad been driving us to Christmas land just to ride in Santa's sleigh. Dad been driving us to Christmas land just to pass the day away." But they were the same song. Haverhill. On the 1st of July, Vic and Wayne put Lake Winnipesaukee in the rearview mirror and drove back to her mother's house in Massachusetts. Vic's house now, she kept forgetting. Lou was flying into Boston to spend the 4th with Wayne and see some big city fireworks, something he had never done before. Vic was going to spend the weekend going through the dead woman's stuff and trying not to drink. She had a notion to sell the house in the fall and move back to Colorado. It was something to talk about with Lou. She could work on search engine anywhere. Traffic was bad on 495. They were trapped on the road under a headache sky of low, fuming clouds. Vic felt that no one should have to put up with a sky like that cold sober. "Do you worry much about ghosts?" Wayne asked while they were idling, waiting for cars in front of them to move. "Why? You creeped out about staying the night at Grandma's? If her spirit is still there, it wouldn't wish you any harm. She loved you." "No," Wayne said, his tone indifferent. "I know ghosts used to talk to you, is all." "Not anymore," she said. And finally, traffic loosened up and Vic could ride the breakdown lane to the exit. "Not ever, kid. Your mom was screwed up in the head. That's why I had to go to the hospital." "They weren't real?" "Of course not. The dead stay dead. The past is past." Wayne nodded. "Who's that?" he asked, looking across the front yard as they turned into the driveway. Vic had been thinking about ghosts, not paying attention, and hadn't seen the woman sitting on her front step. As Vic put the car into park, the visitor rose to her feet. Her visitor wore acid-washed jeans, disintegrating to threads at the knees and thighs, and not in a fashionable way either. She had a cigarette in one hand, trailing a pale wisp of smoke. In the other hand was a folder. She had the stringy, twitchy look of a junkie. Vic could not place her, but was sure she knew her. She had no idea who the visitor was, but felt in some way she had been expecting this woman for years. "Someone you know?" Wayne asked. Vic shook her head. She was temporarily unable to find her voice. She had spent most of the last half year holding tight to both sanity and sobriety, like an old woman clutching a bag of groceries. Staring into the yard, she felt the bottom of the bag beginning to tear and give way. The junkie girl in the unlaced Chuck Taylor high tops raised one hand in a nervous, terribly familiar little wave. Vic opened the car door and got out, came around the front to get between Wayne and the woman. "Can I help you?" Vic croaked. She needed a glass of water. "I hope She sounded as if she were hung up on a sneeze. Her face darkened and she forced out, "So, he's free." "What are you talking about?" "The Wraith," Maggie Lee said. "He's on the road again. I think you should use your bridge and try to find him, Vic." She heard Wayne climbing out of the car behind her, his door thumping shut. He opened the rear door and Hooper leaped from the back seat. She wanted to tell him to get back in the car, but couldn't without signaling her fear. The woman smiled at her. There was an innocence and a simple kindness to her face that Vic very much associated with the mad.
She had seen it often enough in the mental hospital. I'm sorry, the visitor said. That wasn't how I Now she sounded like she might be gagging. Meant to begin. Oh, God. Maggie. Bad stammer. Apologies. We had tea once. You scraped your knee. Long time ago. You weren't much older than your She stopped talking, drew a deep breath, tried again. Kid here. But I think you really must remember. It was awful listening to her try to talk, like watching someone with no legs dragging herself along a sidewalk. Vic thought, she didn't used to be so bad, while at the same time remaining convinced that the junkie girl was a deranged and possibly dangerous stranger. She found herself able to juggle these two notions without any sense of contradicting herself whatsoever. The junkie girl put her hand on Vic's for a moment, but her palm was hot and damp, and Vic quickly pulled away. Vic looked at the girl's arms and saw they were a battlefield of pocked, shiny scars. Cigarette burns. Lots of them. Some livid pink and recent. Maggie regarded her with a brief look of confusion that bordered on hurt. But before Vic could speak, Hooper barged past to poke his nose into Maggie Lee's crotch. Maggie laughed and pushed his snout away. Oh, gee, you have your own Yeti. That's adorbs, she said. She looked beyond the dog to Vic's son. And you must be Wayne. How do you know his name? Vic asked in a hoarse voice, thinking a crazy thing. Her Scrabble tiles can't give her proper names. You dedicated your first book to him, said Maggie. We used to have them all at the library. I was so psyched for you. Vic said, Wayne, take Hooper into the house. Wayne whistled and clicked and walked by Maggie, and the dog shambled after. Wayne firmly shut the door behind both of them. Maggie said, I always thought you'd write. You said you would. I wondered if my might hear from you after Manx was arrested. But then I thought you wanted to put him behind you. I almost wrote you a few times, but first I worried your I worried your folks would question you about me, and later I thought perhaps you wanted to put me behind you as well. She tried to smile again, and Vic saw she was missing teeth. Miss Lee, I think you're confused. I don't know you. I can't help you, Vic said. What frightened Vic most was her feeling that this was exactly backward. Maggie wasn't the one who was confused. Her whole face glistened with lunatic certainty. If anyone was confused, it was Vic. She could see it all in her mind's eye. The dark cool of the library, the yellowing Scrabble tiles scattered on the desk, the bronze paperweight that looked like a pistol. If you don't know me, how come you know my last name? I didn't mention it, Maggie said, only with more stuttering. It took close on half a minute to get this sentence out. Vic held up a hand for silence and ignored this statement as the absurd distraction it was. Of course Maggie had mentioned her last name. She had said it when she introduced herself. Vic was sure. I see you know quite a bit about me, though, Vic continued. Understand that my son knows nothing about Charles Manx. I've never talked to him about the man, and I'm not having him find out from a stranger. She almost said, a crazy person. Of course, I didn't mean to alarm you or But you did anyway. But Vic, stop calling me that. We don't know each other. Would you prefer if I called you the brat? I don't want you to call me anything. I want you to go. But you had to know about In her desperation to get the word out, she seemed to be moaning. Manx, thank you. Yes, we have to decide how to deal with him. Deal with what? What do you mean? Manx is on the road again? He isn't up for parole until 2016, and the last I heard, he was in a coma. Even if he woke up and they did set him free, he'd have to be 200 years old. But they didn't cut him loose, because they would have notified me if they had. He's not that old. Try 150. She sounded like she was imitating the sound of a burning fuse. 15! Jesus Christ, I don't have to listen to this shit. You've got 3 minutes to beat it, lady. If you're still on the lawn after that, I'm calling the police on you. Vic stepped off the path and into the grass, meaning to walk around Maggie to the door. She didn't make it. They didn't notify you they released him because they didn't release him. They think he died last May. Vic caught in place. What do you mean they think he died? Maggie extended the manila folder. She had written a phone number on the inside cover. Vic's gaze caught and held on it, because after the area code, the first 3 digits were her own birthday, and the next 4 numbers were not 4 numbers at all, but the letters F-U, F-U, a kind of obscene stammer in and of themselves. The folder contained perhaps a half dozen printouts from various newspapers on stationery that said, "Here, Public Library. Here, Iowa." The stationery was water-stained and shriveled, foxed at the edges. The first article was from the Denver Post. "Alleged serial killer Charles Talent Manx dies. Leaves questions." There was a thumbnail photo of his mugshot, that gaunt face with its protruding eyes and pale, almost lipless mouth. Vic tried to read the article, but her vision blurred over. She remembered the laundry chute, her eyes streaming and her lungs full of smoke. She remembered thoughtless panic, set to the tune of A Holly Jolly Christmas. Phrases from the article jumped out at her. Degenerative Parkinson's-like illness, intermittent coma, suspected in 12 kidnappings, Thomas Priest, stopped breathing at 2 a.m. "I didn't know," Vic said. "Nobody told me." She was too off balance to keep her rage focused on Maggie. She kept thinking simply, "He's dead. He's dead. And now you can let him go. This part of your life is done because he's dead." The thought didn't bring any joy with it, but she felt the possibility of something better. Relief. "I don't know why they wouldn't tell me he was gone," Vic said. "I bet 'cause they were embarrassed. Look at the next page." Vic glanced wearily up at Margaret Lee, remembering what she had said about Manx being on the road again. She suspected they were getting to it, to Maggie Lee's own particular madness, the lunacy that had driven her to come all the way from here, Iowa, to Haverhill, Massachusetts, just so she could hand this folder to Vic. Vic turned the page. "Alleged serial killer's corpse vanishes. From morgue. Sheriff's department blames morbid vandals." Vic skimmed the first few paragraphs, then closed the folder and offered it back to Maggie. "Some sicko stole the body," Vic said. Maggie said, "Don't think so." She didn't accept the folder. Somewhere down the street, a lawnmower roared to life. For the first time, Vic noticed how hot it was here in the front yard. Even through the overcast, the sun was baking her head. "So you think he faked his death? Well enough to fool 2 doctors? Somehow? Even though they had already begun an autopsy on the body? No. Wait. You think he really died, but then, 48 hours later, he came back to life. Pulled himself out of his drawer at the morgue, got himself dressed, and walked out." Maggie's face, her whole body, relaxed in an expression of profound relief. "Yes. I've come so far to see you, Vic, because I just knew you'd believe me. Now look at the next article. There's a guy in Kentucky who disappeared from his home in an antique Rolls-Royce. Manx's Rolls-Royce. The article doesn't say it was the one that belonged to Manx, but if you look at the picture..." "I'm not going to look at shit," Vic said, and threw the folder in Maggie's face. "Get the fuck out of my yard, you crazy bitch." Maggie's mouth opened and closed, just like the mouth of the big old koi in the fish tank that was a central feature of her little office in the Here Public Library, which Vic could remember perfectly, even though she had never been there. Vic's rage was boiling over at last, and she wanted to scald Maggie with it. It was not just that Maggie was blocking the way to Vic's door, or that with her mad babble she threatened to undermine Vic's own sense of what was true, to steal from Vic her hard-won sanity. It was that Manx was dead, really dead. But this lunatic couldn't let Vic have that. Charlie Manx, who had kidnapped God knew how many children, who had kidnapped and terrorized and nearly killed Vic herself, Charlie Manx was in the dirt. Vic had escaped him at last. Only Margaret fucking Lee wanted to bring him back, dig him up, make Vic afraid of him again. "Pick that shit up when you go," Vic told her. She stepped on some of the papers as she proceeded around Maggie to the door. She was careful not to put her foot on the dirty, sun-faded fedora sitting on the edge of the bottom step. "He's not done, Vic," Maggie said. "That's why I wanted, was hoping you could try to find him. I know I told you not to back when we first met, but you were too young then. You weren't ready. Now I think you're the only person who can find him. Who can stop him? If you still know how. Because if you don't, I'm worried he'll try and find you. The only thing I plan to find is a phone to call the police. If I were you, I wouldn't be here when they show up," Vic said. Then turning back and getting into Maggie Lee's face, she said, "I don't know you. Take your crazy somewhere else." "But Vic," Maggie said, and lifted a finger. "Don't you remember? I gave you those earrings." Vic walked inside and slammed the door. Wayne, who was standing just 3 paces away and who had probably heard the whole thing, jumped. Hooper, who was right behind him, cringed and whined softly, turned and trotted off, looking for someplace happier to be. Vic turned back to the door and leaned her forehead against it and took a deep breath. It was half a minute before she was ready to look through the fisheye spy hole into the front yard. Maggie was just straightening up from the front step, carefully placing her filthy fedora on her head with a certain dignity. She gave the front door of Vic's house a last forlorn look, then turned and limped away down the lawn. She didn't have a car and was in for a long, hot, 6-block walk to the closest bus station. Vic watched her until she was out of sight, watched and idly stroked the earrings she was wearing, favorites since she was a kid, a pair of Scrabble tiles, F and U. By the Road. When Wayne went out half an hour later to walk Hooper, no, check that, to get away from his mother and her mood of pressurized unhappiness, the folder was sitting on the top step, all the papers neatly shuffled back into it. He glanced over his shoulder, through the still open door, but his mother was up in the kitchen, out of sight. Wayne shut the door. He bent and picked up the folder, opened it, and glanced at a thin stack of printouts. Alleged serial killer. Morbid vandals. Boeing engineer vanishes. He folded the sheaf of paper into quarters and put it in the back pocket of his shorts. He shoved the empty folder down behind the hedges, planted along the front of the house. Wayne was not sure he wanted to look at them and, at just 12 years old, was still not self-aware enough to know he had already decided to look at them, that he had made his decision the moment he shoved the folder out of sight behind the hedge. He crossed the lawn and sat on the curb. He felt as if he were carrying nitroglycerin in his back pocket. He stared across the street at a lawn of wilted, yellowing grass. The old guy who lived over there was really letting his yard go. The guy had a funny name, Sig DeZote, and a room full of little model soldiers. Wayne had wandered over the day of Graham's funeral, and the old guy had showed them to him, being nice. He had told Wayne that once upon a time his mother, Vic, had painted a few of his figures. "Your mother have a fine brush even then," he said, with an accent like a Nazi.
Then his nice old wife had made Wayne a glass of frosted iced tea with slices of orange in it that had tasted just about like heaven. Wayne thought about going over there to look at the old guy's soldiers again. It would be out of the heat, and it would take his mind off the printouts in his back pocket that he probably shouldn't look at. He even got as far as pushing himself up off the curb and getting ready to cross the street. But then he looked back at his own house and sat down again. His mother wouldn't like it if he wandered off without saying where he was going, and he didn't think he could head back into the house and ask permission yet. So he stayed where he was and looked at the wilting lawn across the street and missed the mountains. Wayne had seen a landslide once, just last winter. He had been up above Longmont with his father to tow a Mercedes that had slid off the road and down an embankment. The family that had been in the car were shaken up but unhurt. They were a normal family. A mom, a dad, two kids. The little girl even had blonde pigtails. That's how normal they were. Wayne could tell, just looking at them, that the mom had never been in a mental asylum and that the father didn't have stormtrooper armor hanging in his closet. He could tell that the children had normal names, like John and Sue, as opposed to bearing names lifted from a comic book. They had skis on the roof of the Mercedes, and the father asked Lou if he took Amex. Not American Express, Amex. Within minutes of meeting them, Wayne loved the whole family with an irrational fierceness. Lou sent Wayne down the embankment with the hook and the winch line, but as the boy edged toward the car, there came a sound from high above, a splintering crack, loud as a gunshot. Everyone looked up into the snowy peaks, the sharp-edged Rockies rising above them through the pines. As they stared, a white sheet of snow, as wide and long as a football field, came loose and began to slide. It was half a mile to the south, so they were in no danger. After the first crack of its letting go, they could barely even hear it. It was no more than a low roll of distant thunder. Although Wayne could feel it, it registered as a gentle thrum in the ground beneath him. That great shelf of snow slid a few hundred yards and hit the tree line and exploded in a white blast, a tidal wave of snow 30 feet high. The father who had an Amex lifted his boy up and set him on his shoulders to watch. "We are in the wild now, little guy," he said, while an acre of mountaintop forest was smothered under 600 tons of snow. "Isn't that a goddamn," Lou said, and looked down the embankment at Wayne. His father's face shone with happiness. Can you imagine being underneath it? Can you imagine all that shit coming down on you? Wayne could, and did, all the time. He thought it would be the best way to die, wiped out in a brilliant crash of snow and light, the world roaring around you as it slid apart. Bruce Wayne Carmody had been unhappy for so long that it had stopped being a state he paid attention to. Sometimes Wayne felt that the world had been sliding apart beneath his feet for years. He was still waiting for it to pull him down, to bury him at last. His mother had been crazy for a while, had believed that the phone was ringing when it wasn't, had conversations with dead children who weren't there. Sometimes he felt she had talked more with dead children than she ever had with him. She had burned down their house. She spent a month in a psychiatric hospital, skipped out on a court appearance, and dropped out of Wayne's life for almost 2 years. She spent a while on book tour, visiting bookstores in the morning and local bars at night. She hung out in L.A. for 6 months, working on a cartoon version of Search Engine that never got off the ground, and a cocaine habit that did. She spent a while drawing covered bridges for a gallery show that no one went to. Wayne's father got sick of Vic's drinking. Vic's wandering, and Vic's crazy. And he took up with the lady who had done most of his tattoos, a girl named Carol who had big hair and dressed like it was still the 80s. Only Carol had another boyfriend, and they stole Lou's identity and ran off to California, where they racked up a $10,000 debt in Lou's name. Lou was still dealing with creditors. Bruce Wayne Carmody wanted to love and enjoy his parents, and occasionally he did, but they made it hard. Which was why the papers in his back pocket felt like nitroglycerin, a bomb that hadn't exploded yet. He supposed if there was any chance it might go off later, he ought to have a look,
figure out how much damage it could do and how best to shelter himself from the blast. He pulled the papers out of his back pocket, took a last secretive glance at his house, and folded the pages open on his knee. The first newspaper article featured a photo of Charles Talent Manx, the dead serial killer. Manx's face was so long it looked like it had melted a little. He had protruding eyes and a goofy overbite and a bald, bulging skull that bore a resemblance to a cartoon dinosaur egg. This man, Charles Manx, had been arrested above Gun Barrel almost 15 years ago. He was a kidnapper who transported an unnamed minor across state lines, then burned a man to death for trying to stop him. No one knew how old he was when they locked him up. He didn't thrive in jail. By 2001, he was in a coma in the hospital wing of the Supermax in Denver. He lingered like that for 11 years before passing away last May. After that, the article was mostly bloodthirsty speculation. Manx had a hunting cottage outside Gun Barrel, where the trees were hung with hundreds of Christmas ornaments. The press dubbed the place the Sleigh House, which managed two puns, neither of them any good. The article implied he had been imprisoning and slaughtering children there for years. It mentioned only in passing that no bodies had ever been discovered on the grounds. What did any of this have to do with Victoria McQueen, mother of Bruce Wayne Carmody? Nothing, as far as Wayne could see. Maybe if he looked at the other articles, he would figure it out. He went on. Alleged serial killer's corpse vanishes from morgue was next. Someone had broken into St. Luke's Medical Center in Denver, slugged a security guard, and made off with dead old Charlie Manx. The body snatcher had swiped a Trans Am from the parking lot across the street, too. The third piece was a clipping from a paper in Louisville, Kentucky, and didn't have a damn thing to do with Charles Manx. It was titled, Boeing Engineer Vanishes, Local Mystery Troubles Police, IRS. It was accompanied by a photograph of a tanned and wiry man with a thick black mustache, leaning against an old Rolls Royce, elbows resting on the hood. Bruce frowned his way through the story. Nathan Demeter had been reported missing by his teenage daughter, who had returned from school to find the house unlocked, the garage open, a half-eaten lunch on the table, and her father's antique Rolls Royce gone. The IRS seemed to think Demeter might have skipped out to evade prosecution for income tax evasion. His daughter didn't believe it, said he was either kidnapped or dead, but there was no way he would have run out on her without telling her why and where he was going. What any of this had to do with Charles Talent Manx, Wayne couldn't see. He thought maybe he had missed something, wondered if he ought to go back to the start and reread everything. He was just about to flip back to the first of the photocopies when he spotted Hooper, squatting in the yard across the street, dropping turds the size of bananas in the grass. They were the colors of bananas, too. Green ones. "Oh, no!" Wayne cried. "Oh, no, big guy!" He dropped the papers on the sidewalk and started across the street. His first thought was to haul Hooper out of the yard before anyone saw. But the curtain twitched in one of the front windows of the house across the street. Someone, the nice old guy or his nice old wife, had been watching. Wayne supposed the best thing he could do was go over there and make a joke out of it, ask if they had a bag he could use to clean up the mess. The old guy with his Dutch accent seemed like he could laugh at just about anything. Hooper rose, unfolding from his hunch. Wayne hissed at him. "You're bad. You're so bad." Hooper wagged his tail, pleased to have Wayne's attention. Wayne was about to climb the steps to the front door of Sigmund Desoat's house when he noticed shadows flickering along the lower edge of the door. When Wayne glanced at the spy hole, he thought he saw a blur of color and movement. Someone stood 3 feet away, right on the other side of the door, watching him. "Hello?" he called from the bottom of the steps. "Mr. Desoat?" The shadows shifted at the bottom of the door, but no one acknowledged him. The lack of a response disquieted Wayne. The backs of his arms prickled with chill. "Oh, stop it. You're just being stupid because you read those scary stories about Charlie Manx. Go up there and ring the bell." Wayne shook off his unease and began climbing the brick steps, extending one hand for the doorbell. He did not observe that the handle of the door was already beginning to turn,
the person on the other side preparing to swing it open. The other side of the door. Bing Partridge stood at the spy hole. In his left hand was the doorknob. In his right was the gun, the .38 Mr. Manx had brought from Colorado.
"Boy, boy, go away," Bing whispered, his voice thin and strained with need. "Come again some other day."
Bing had a plan, a simple but desperate plan. When the boy reached the top of the steps, he would throw open the door and pull him into the house. Bing had a can of gingerbread smoke in his pocket, and as soon as he had the kid inside, he could gas him out. And if the kid began screaming? If the kid screamed and struggled to get free? Someone was having a barbecue down at the end of the block. Kids in the front yard chucking a frisbee, grown-ups drinking too much and laughing too loud and getting sunburned. Bing might not be the sharpest knife in the kitchen, but he was no fool either. Bing thought a man in a gas mask, with a pistol in one hand, might attract some notice wrestling with a screaming child. And there was the dog. What if the dog lunged? It was a St. Bernard, big as a bear cub. If it got its big bear cub head in through the door, Bing would never be able to force it back out. It would be like trying to hold the door shut on a herd of cattle. Mr. Manx would know what to do, but he was asleep. He had been asleep for more than a day now, was resting in Sigmund Dezote's bedroom. When he was awake, he was his good old self. Good old Mr. Manx! But when he nodded off, it sometimes seemed he would never wake again. He said he would be better when he was on his way to Christmasland, and Bing knew that it was true. But he had never seen Mr. Manx so old, and when he slept, it was like seeing him dead. And what if Bing forced the boy into the house? Bing was not sure he could wake Mr. Manx when he was like he was. How long could they hide here before Victoria McQueen was out in the street screaming for her child, before the cops were going door to door? It was the wrong place and the wrong time. Mr. Manx had made it clear they were only to watch for now, and even Bing, who was not the sharpest pencil in the desk, could see why. This sleepy street was not sleepy enough, and they would only get one pass at the whore with her whore tattoos and her lying whore mouth. Mr. Manx had made no threats, but Bing knew how much this mattered to him and understood what the penalty would be if he fucked it up. Mr. Manx would never take Bing to Christmasland. Never, 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 never! The boy climbed the first step and the second.
"I wish I may. I wish I might. First star I see tonight," Bing whispered and shut his eyes and readied himself to act. "Have the wish I wish tonight. Go the fuck away, you little bastard. We're not ready."
He swallowed rubber-tasting air and cocked the hammer on the big pistol. And then someone was in the street, shouting for the boy, shouting, "No! Way, no!" Bing's nerve endings throbbed and the gun came dangerously close to slipping out of his sweaty hand. A big silver boat of a car rolled down the road, spokes of sunshine flashing off the rims. It pulled to a halt directly in front of Victoria McQueen's house. The window was down, and the driver hung one flabby arm out, waving it at the kid.
"Yo!" he shouted again. "Yo, Wayne!"
Yo, not no. Bing was in such a state of nervous tension that he had heard him wrong.
"What's up, dude?"
yelled the fat man.
"Dad!"
the child yelled. He forgot all about climbing the steps and knocking on the door, turned and ran down the path, his fucking pet bear galloping alongside. Bing seemed to go boneless. His legs were wobbly with relief. He sank forward, resting his forehead against the door, and shut his eyes. When he opened them and looked through the spy hole, the child was in his father's arms. The driver was morbidly obese, a big man with a shaved head and telephone pole legs. That had to be Lewis Carmody, the father. Bing had read up about the family online, had a general sense of who was who, but had never seen a picture of the man. He was amazed. He could not imagine Carmody and McQueen having sex. The fat beast would split her in two. Bing wasn't exactly buff, but he'd look like a fucking track star next to Carmody.
He wondered what hold the man had on her to have induced her to have sex with him. Perhaps they had come to financial terms. Bing had looked the woman over at length and would not be surprised. All those tattoos. A woman could get any tattoo she liked, but they all said the same thing. They were a sign reading, "Available for Rent." The breeze caught the papers the boy had been looking at, and they drifted under the fat man's car. When Carmody set his child back on the ground, the boy looked around for them and spotted them, but didn't get down on all fours to retrieve them. Those papers were...